Okay, so I did give a quick read through them. The first question, yeah, I'll deal with this first. It's one that actually, I'm not sure if I'm in a great position to answer, but the question is about just interested in my point of view on college kids going away for college and not coming back to the home church. And how can the home church help them to keep growing and to keep them at church to serve and grow the home church? And it's a great question, a great concern. When I said earlier today, one of the things I appreciate about the church while I'm here is that one of the things that you have, and this is not necessarily that better than my church, but just something that you have that we don't, which is longevity. I'm meeting people here that have said we've known each other for 30 years. We're doing life together. And the fact that there are a number of people that I've met, you know, current college students or graduates who grew up in the church and are still part of the church. And that's part of the basis for the kind of thing I'm admired, which, to go into more details, is sort of this sense of, like, there's these long-term relationships where you're doing life together. I quite appreciate and value that. But on this particular question, the reason I say that I'm not in a position to answer is because I'm trying to figure this out myself, because the Manhattan context is so different. So, again, I grew up in Brooklyn, and therefore, a lot of what I'm hearing about the way your families are doing things and kids going away and coming back is how it was for people that I grew up with. Whereas in Manhattan, nearly everyone in my church has come from someplace else. They've left their families for their careers. They're starting new families. They're having kids where their parents aren't around. And now that we've been around, our church is in our 22nd or 23rd year, we're first starting to get kids that grew up in the church, went off to college. But the assumption is they're not necessarily moving back to New York City, or they're not moving home with their parents, where they may have gone and then the parents left and then they come back to New York City. So that's where I'm not in the best position to answer this particular question by experience. But a couple of quick thoughts. I think going away to college, both of my kids chose to go away, so they're in Illinois, and we live quite close to City College, so I was making a pitch for City College where it's affordable and they can live at home, and that was not appealing. But so my kids are away, and one thing that was important for me as a Christian parent was to know that they're going someplace that has community. So they happen to choose Christian colleges, but I think I was encouraging my son to go to a SUNY school that might have a good campus fellowship. So one aspect of the going away is, what does it look like to provide encouragement that they stay engaged in the church during the years where, since they don't have to go, since you won't know that they're not going, part of that is loving them, trusting the Lord. But this question, it feels like the emphasis is more on what happens after college. And the only thought that I have here is to just share to challenge the consumer mindset that I think is natural to all of us, which is, the first question is, what can I do for myself? In Christianity, there's a sense in which, well, as you give yourself, you're really growing. And what I would wonder about with my own kids is, are you making a decision based solely on what can I get and not only what can I give? And I think for a church like yours that has longevity, to not require it, I don't think it's necessarily unfaithful for a kid could have good reasons to choose going to another church. But to say, but to teach them to make sure that they understand, but actually coming back and now investing in the community that you grew up in and being a leader and being a role model, the Bible does have it's covenantal theology of how God works in generations. And so being able to have a sense of, like, well, actually, now that you're older, there's an opportunity that you can play a positive role that shouldn't be devalued. So I don't know for a lot of kids if that would be compelling. But at least to keep on the radar that part of your own growth is taking responsibility for what you have and contributing it. So you could go to a different church and contribute there. But are there unique things you can do to really carry on the heritage? Those are my thoughts. But it's a weak answer because I wasn't a Christian in college, and my church people have left their context, and so I don't have the experience to answer that in any more of an informed way. So you can come back, when I'm done with everything, you can raise your hand and I could try to clarify or narrow or fix things, but that's as good as we're getting on that. But here's the next one. Could you share a little bit of, okay, this is also one that's a great question, but I'll do slightly better on this one. But so could you share a little bit about your dating relationship and marriage relationship and how God uses it to serve in ministry and serve the people in different stages of your marriage? What's some advice you can give to dating and new married couples? And the reason I'm laughing about myself is because, so I became a Christian coming out of college. So as a new Christian, I realized everything I know about dating was formed, you know, by watching Friends and reading magazines or whatever. So I realized I really needed to rethink through how I think about dating and relationships. So I actually, I've done a lot of thinking and have overthought it, but part of my own story was discerning if I was called to singleness. So when I became a new Christian, I thought, well, let me just not date anyone because I don't want to do damage. So let me just figure out what a Christian is supposed to do in dating. And I was actually a content enough person and didn't necessarily want to get married or the appeal of having children. I just didn't understand it. So then I met the woman that I'm now married to. Her name is Kathy. And I was interested in her, and it raised for me this question of, like, so what Paul talked about, like, actually, is it better for you to remain single? So I thought, as a minister, could I devote all of my time and energy by not having to divide things? But also, I was at Redeemer Presbyterian Church at that point, and there were a lot of people who were so career-focused that they thought, I'm just going to wait till I get married until I get my career in order. And then they were 45 or 50, and then they realized that there were, you know, few people around, and they were very unhappy in their singleness. So I thought, well, what if I just commit to singleness and try to enjoy the single life and be able to minister to other single people? But then I had a particular female that I was interested in. So I went to Charlie Drew, who was the founding pastor of my church. Some of you may know who he is. And I asked this question about what is a call to singleness and what would be better for long-term ministry. And his advice, which I think was good, which was to say, okay, at this point, you're in your late 20s. You know what it's like to be a single guy. You had that experience. But actually, do you know what it's like to be married and to be a parent? And if you want to be effective for ministry, wouldn't it be good to maybe, if you're inclined to get married anyway? So my first answer to this about how dating and marriage, how God uses it for ministry, in my own life, actually, I had all these great theories about love. Then you need to love an actual person, and you find that your theory is too theoretical, and your confidence in how compassionate and kind and loving you are is limited. Now, I happen to marry this wonderfully kind, patient woman. So for me, having children, and my children are very good, but that then tested in new ways my patience, my long-suffering. And in my case, I found that marriage and family, God used it to really help me deepen in living things out that then helped clarify for me a number of things. One is that in my sense of call to singleness, my view was, well, actually, I'm supposed to be content in the Lord. And I found that that was really valuable for them being married, to make sure that now that I'm married, it's not like, okay, now I have somebody else who's fulfilling me, and God is no longer doing that. That puts so much pressure on a spouse to be something that nobody can live up to. So what was helpful for me is to get a sense of, at the end of the day, even though I'm married, my fulfillment, this primary relationship with the Lord is meant to sustain me. And that has allowed me to then bring the love of God into my relationship, to stay with an imperfect person and not go into my self-pitying modes, for the two of us to be together and do the challenge of parenting. So from that, I think where my wife and I have then been able to be an encouragement to other couples is to recognize within a Christian couple to say, well, make sure that you're both still finding your ultimate hope and satisfaction is not in the person you're married to, but in the Lord. And so you're not choosing between the two, but you're just making sure that the primary thing, so that way if you find I'm disappointed that the spouse is not enough, it's sort of like, well, the spouse will never be enough. The Lord will be enough. And so maybe God gave you the spouse you need and is testing your dependence. And so in that sense, I think one of the things my wife and I have been able to do is to show that actually the best chance we have at enduringly loving one another is to make sure that we're both loving God, we're encouraging one another to love God, and then from that, we're enjoying the relationship. And so what advice to dating and newly married couples? You know, I think that might be the primary lesson that I learned is if you're dating somebody, to remember you're not looking for that perfect person who's going to complete you, because no person can do that. So find somebody that has traits that are enduring for you. For me, in the case of my wife, I saw that she had godly character and I respected her. And that was important because, you know, the nature of the tempter, you read Genesis 3, and then as soon as Adam and Eve sin, they turn against one another. So, you know, when Adam is asked, why are you hiding? And he says, the woman that you gave me. Immediately, that's the nature of Satan, who's a divider and accuser. And so when you're sharing life with somebody, when things aren't going well, my self-pity narrative could almost be like, you know, Lord, why did you give me this imperfect spouse? Not realizing actually part of the problem is my lack of love. And so one thing that's helped me not to fall for that, because my wife, she's not perfect, but she really is wonderful, and she has such character. So at times when I found myself thinking, like, look how great I am and how I have to patiently endure with this person, I've caught myself saying, that's not true. I know that's not true. So don't fall for that. And I have to say, I actually married her because she's this honorable, faithful person, and she's not perfect. But right now, it's my pride that's making me think that I'm suffering with this less than person. And I've caught myself needing to repent and realize, Lord, I was tempted here. So I would say, make sure that you are focused on the Lord being your primary relationship, and that if you are going to commit your life to marrying somebody, that you're looking for somebody that has something substantial. And then once you're married, then you have to deal with the person that you're married to. So as you find out that they are surprisingly less perfect than you anticipated, at that point you don't make the plan, the exit plan. You make the, okay, Lord, this is what you've given me, because either you've prepared me to give myself to this person, or you've put a characteristic in this person that's going to challenge me to grow deeper, and therefore it's not unfair that I have to suffer, but this must be part of your plan of sanctification. So I think that view of marriage allows a couple to endure. I've been married now 22 years. I have to think about it. And it's been, for a guy that didn't want to be married, and part of it for me was my own selfishness. Of the various things, I've never had a point where, in those 22 years, where I said, I wish I was not married to this person. And for a guy like me, that's maturity. That's because as a single guy, boy, did I think differently. And that, I think, part of it was of just knowing, like, okay, here I'm disappointed, but Lord, I'm going to lean on you. And here's two imperfect people trying to figure it out. I think we've been able to do that. And so as a couple, that's what we try to do with other couples, which is to say, okay, right now you're both dissatisfied. But what's the truth of this? The truth is, things may be better than you think. And the truth is also, you might both need to grow, and how are you going to grow there? In all of that, there was probably at least one or two good sentences. So you'll have to figure that out. All right. How can we help our parents who worry easily? They are Christians, but they worry about everything, including me, my well-being of their children, and their family, and their own health as well. So that it's a great question, because it's a caring question. You know, you love your parents, and parental worry for children is love. So the basis of this is like, wow, that, you know, there's a good basis there, even if the anxiety says something's not quite right. And I do think the mindset of Jesus in Matthew 6, the passage that we looked at today, which is to say, at the end of the day, worry is not helping us. So the question, how can you help your parents who worry easily? Well, there might be some simple things that just by disclosure you could provide assurance for them. Which is to say, hey, by the way, I know you're concerned that, right now I'm making these choices, but let me just be transparent why I think this is wise. And so part of it is just being honest and helping them with the things that they're worried about. But in this question, if I'm reading these, the parents are Christians. Yeah, so if the parents are Christians, I think there's a common basis where then, you know, you want to, I think, respectfully meet them where they're worried. First of all, be patient, recognize their worry is an expression of, at its heart, it's love, even though if it's love that comes with the uncertainty. So appreciate, recognize, respect that. And then how do you love them back? Well, if you can provide them assurance in some way that the thing that they're worrying about, that there's maybe less to worry, to give them as much as you can. But at the end of the day, parents just worry. And so therefore, I think bringing into the conversation the kind of thing to say, hey, I understand you're worried about me, but I don't have a full plan, but I'm trusting the Lord, and I'm trying to be wise. And if you're disagreeing with my being wise, I would just encourage you to trust the Lord with me. Pray for me. Let's talk about it. But remember that our worrying is not helping us solve the problem. So thank you for loving me. I love you. Let's not let the worry turn us against one another, but let's trust the Lord. And if you think I need to be corrected, be kind about it, be humble about it. I'll try to be carefully listening, and I may disagree and navigate my own life. But I think navigating it that way, where I ended the last talk is, at the end of the day, the Lord is with us. And I think one of the ways you can help your anxious parents is to remember you're still with them. So even if you're making choices that they disagree with, but I'm still going to honor you. I still appreciate you. I recognize your love. Don't worry. You've taught me well. I may disagree in a certain number of areas, but let's trust the Lord. That might go a long way. And then there was a second question here about how long it took to prepare each sermon. So basically, during breakfast, when the other guy was praying for the food, I just said, Lord, give me something to say. And I suppose about 10 seconds is probably what I spent on each of those times. No. I don't know. Part of it is because, being an anxious person, I'm always thinking, and therefore, I suspect in terms of actual work, I probably spent, typically for a sermon, I spend about 15 hours. In this case, there were certain efficiencies in which there were two main topics over two. So I was doing a lot of reading, but I would do reading that would be on, you know, all of the reading went to two topics, so it wasn't five different topics. I also had already been reading on these topics. So there's a sense in which a lot of my time was not finding new information, but trying to go back to my notes and pull out from that. So between studying the passage, between going back to what I've read, and then taking on a couple of new things that I felt like, oh yeah, if I'm going to speak about anxiety, here's a book that might be helpful. So if the book took 10 hours to read, you know, if you distributed that 5 hours for each talk, going through my notes, my Bible study, and all of that. So it was probably about 15 hours of actual sitting down behind the computer for each of the talks, I'm guessing. But it was a lot of standing in the shower and thinking like, oh yeah, you know, whatever you're worried. It could have been 30 or 40 hours, but that's the call of the minister, that whatever thinking I was doing here may in 3 weeks show up in some sermon. So the short answer is I suspect about 15 hours per talk. But the plus minus margin of error there could be 60% or something. About 15 hours, it could be 7, it could have been 29, I'm not sure. All right. Next question. Oh yes, there were two questions that were on a similar topic, so I might try to tackle them together, although it's... So one is about at work. People in the workplace carry a lot of anger, so how do you deal with angry people, an angry coworker? This is not exactly the same, but one was about dealing with your children, and the description was, so it's interesting, the term entitled children. In one of my talks, I meant to talk about the problem of entitlement, and then I think I skipped it. I don't know that I used that term. But that actually is one of the issues of a recipe for anger. So if you have entitled children, how are you dealing with them as they deal with their anxiety or anger? So my understanding of that question is not how do you help your children with their anxiety or anger, but how do you as the parent deal with an anxious, angry child? I think that's what the question's getting at. So I think the answer, for the reason I'm taking both questions together, is because they're both about how do you deal with angry people around you. And one of the ways I was defining anger is, is a boundary has been overstepped, a protective boundary in your life. And so now there's something threatening that you need to respond to. And one of the ways of existing around other people that are angry is clarifying what your own boundaries are. What you think is acceptable and what's not acceptable. And then trying to stay in relationship to them, where you can patiently love them, where you're genuinely giving yourself to them, but minimizing their dragging you down. That's the tough thing. That's the danger of anger. We all get angry, so we can't ignore the angry person. Now, the coworker is a little bit different, because the coworker may not be a Christian. You may not have much of an obligation to them. And therefore, dealing with them could be a little bit more protective, that you might just need to decide, you know, outside of my obligations with that person, I'm not going to have much interaction with them. Now, you may, from a mission perspective, say, but God has placed me in this workplace, and I can see that this angry person is alienating everyone around them, but I'm going to do the work to befriend them. And that, but in terms of boundaries, the important thing is you're setting that. You're saying, okay, God, I'm going to extend my boundary here, and I'm going to subject myself to a little bit of this person's difficulty in order to love them. That feels different from, here I am trying to get my thing done, and then this person's intruding, because then you're overstepping my boundary. That's where grace allows you to extend the boundary, to say, I'm going to give room for this imperfect person to be a little bit short, a little bit frustrated, but there's still whatever that protective edge is, and part of that is your own character work to realize, like, okay, you know, I want people to like me, to be impressed with me. This angry person is going to say something mean. To realize their statement is not a reflection on me, so I don't need to be hurt by it. It's a statement, it's a reflection on them not dealing with their anger well. So is my boundary able to be around that person, have them say something and it rolls off of my shoulders and doesn't affect me? Some of you may find, I can't do that. It's mean, and so therefore the boundary needs to be, yeah. You know, to be honest, I'm finding that, you know, where you have a conversation with a coworker, you know, you seem to be pretty frustrated. You're taking this out on things that I'm not responsible for. And I'm finding it difficult enough that I would prefer that we keep it on the business. So that's having a clear, firm boundary. For some of you, that's really hard to do. But once you do that, it makes clear that then when the person comes in and they yell at you, you can say, hey, actually, this looks like it's more about your anger than about my failing, because this particular thing you're yelling at me doesn't have to do with me. Now, sometimes it may have to do with your failing, and then the boundary is, yes, I did wrong. But we're coworkers here, and insulting me just because I did something wrong, that doesn't seem okay. Can we stay on the topic? It takes a lot of work and confidence to be able to be the kind of person to do that. So here, in saying that, I'm actually terrible at doing that. The reason I know to do that is because I'm trying to constantly figure out how to do it. So I know what to do. I don't always do it. But I do think part of dealing with difficult people is having that boundary. Now, when you're a parent, it's harder because you have an obligation to the child. And so one of my kids went through a year of just going through a hard time, and it came out with some inappropriate anger towards me. And one of the things that helped me was, okay, here's God, my Father, who loves me, and he's taught me so much, and I keep doing so much wrong, and he's bearing patiently with me. So for me, there was a sense of like, okay, as a father, I'm willing to absorb some of this. It's unfair, but I'm willing to absorb it. I think in the case of my children, I've still tried to think of where is the boundary line to say, I'm going to give you enough space to know that, like, I don't know what happened, but you went to school, something happened that got you angry, and you couldn't deal with it there. So you come home, and you can't tell your teacher who embarrassed you by calling on you when you didn't know the answer. You can't tell the teacher that you resent them, but you can come home and say you resent me. But it actually might be you resent the teacher that you can't talk to, and because I love you, you're able to get away with saying you resent me. And it's unfair. And, you know, why do I have to bear this? But on the other hand, I try to navigate how much of this is my absorbing it in a way to love you so that you can be yourself and to know that you trust me enough that hopefully it will come around. And then part of it, I did go through a period with one of my kids where there was a self-protective of kind of like, actually at this point, it's a bit sinful, and it's not good for you, and it's not good for me for you to say this. So I had to have a clear, like, I know you're angry, but that was over the line. And I think that that clarity in the short term, in some cases, increased the, oh, see, you don't get it. But with this one particular kid who went through a tough period, like 4 years later, apologized, came, and the Lord just showed him, hey, that was a period where I think with some reflection, he realized that he was taking some of his life frustration out inappropriately at home. And it was healing to hear that. It was restorative to our relationship. And yet, I still bear some of the pain of some of that inappropriate. The reality is, it was hurtful to have a kid that I love, taking some of that out on me. And so I saw my job was to bear it. But there was a protective sense of like, okay, I'm going to absorb this hostility, but it's not good for me, it's not good for you. So what is the line where I can say, this isn't okay? And I tried to navigate that line, and the Lord used it redemptively. And so I have a good relationship with all my kids. They're not perfect. I'm not the perfect parent. But my thought there of dealing with an angry kid is that, now the language of entitlement, you know, a side note, sometimes things get more complicated, that there's what psychologists would call a personality disorder. There are some people, by the way they're wired, their experiences, that they're just going to be angry, and no matter how reasonable you are, you can't necessarily help them out of it. And in that case, what's really hard as a parent is having a firmer boundary where you say, you know, at this point, this looks like entitlement. This doesn't look like you're having a tough time in life. It looks like you're just angry and I'm here to help you. I will provide the resources, but you can't, like, for example, if now your anger is causing problems for your siblings, I need to protect the siblings by saying you can't come home and keep doing that. That's really hard. But the main thing is to not be vengeful and spiteful, to not say, I hate you for what you're doing, so I'm going to punish you. But to be more protective, to say, this is not good for us, it's not good for you, and where are the lines to say, for the sake of health, you know, you can't cross that line. And I think that's important, to not get vengeful. You hurt me, I'm going to hurt you back. That doesn't love our children. To say, you've hurt me, and I'm not going to allow you to keep hurting me, so there needs to be a line. That gives the potential for growth rather than getting pulled into somebody else's anger. So those are some thoughts about dealing with angry people around you. Two more questions, so we should only be here for about an hour and a half. All right, I'll try to. So sometimes I can see better with my glasses off. I was told that not everyone is destined to become Christian due to the concept of irresistible grace. People are chosen by God at birth to become Christian, and those who are not chosen can never accept God. Is this true? And if so, how is this fair? If I am not one of these chosen, does this mean I was doomed from birth and nothing matters? So this is a really good question, and by the nature of it, one that will not have a brief answer that's satisfying. I will still try to be brief. I will admit up front that it won't be fully satisfying. But this is a topic that gets deeper into the mystery of how God works in overseeing the world. And therefore, Christians disagree on what the language of Scripture is. I mean, when Scripture talks about election, when it talks about God's sovereignty, how does this work? What we all have to grapple with is, well, what does the Bible teach? What language? But also, why does the Bible teach it? What is it showing us? And then, what is the Bible not saying? But are there other passages of the Bible that help us make a decision here, or what's reasonable? So when it comes to something like this, the Bible clearly talks about election. The question didn't use that term, but that's the category we're in. God chooses. This used language of irresistible grace, which is the idea that hey, if God calls you, you will answer. You know, if the Spirit really works in you, you can't resist the power of the Spirit. On the other hand, if your heart is hard, you can't agree to be a Christian just because you want to, because God needs to do that work. And so what's clear in the Bible is that the Bible uses the language of election. You know, read Ephesians 1, read Romans 8. And then concepts, like if you read John's Gospel, John doesn't use the language of election, but Jesus says something like, my sheep know my voice. No one can come to the Father but through me. So these concepts are there. And then, so what the question, because part of the question was about fairness, if I'm understanding it right, and do I actually make a free choice? So one of the questions when we talk about election is, well, why does the Bible talk about it? And you go to Ephesians 1, and you go to Romans 8, you go to Galatians, and the passages that are more explicit. And there's a number of reasons, but two of the major reasons where the Bible talks about election is, one, to humble us, and two, to encourage us. And so, for instance, in Romans 8, then it goes into 9 to 11, where it's talking about the relationship of Jews and Gentiles. And Paul talks about election, and one thing that he's saying is, remember, it's not that you were smarter than others, it's not that you were more holy or righteous, but it's because God set his love on you. And therefore, if there are some, so in Romans 9 to 11, he's talking about Jews that haven't believed the Messiah, they're like a branch being broken off of a tree, and now you who weren't part of the nation of Israel have been put in. This is God's chosen nation, now you're a chosen people here. One of the applications is to be humble. If you are a Christian, you are an heir of God's grace. God has given you great things. Be careful not to think you're better than other people. So are you smarter than the non-Christian who's not believing? The answer is no. It's because God, by his grace, showed you something. And because he showed you, because it was his spirit, his revelation, you believe it. But that's God's kindness to you. So don't be arrogant. And then the second application with election, I think a key one, these aren't the only two, but these feel like the dominant ones if you look in the context. The second one is, be encouraged. Because there's always the tendency, if I trust, you know, sort of the Baptist approach is more like, hey, we baptize you because you professed faith. And therefore, we're going to celebrate you and your faith. And that's good. It's true. We really do believe and we should celebrate. But the Reformed approach is to say, but even our faith, in Ephesians it talks about we're saved by grace through faith, that it's grace first, that God opens our eyes, he forgives us, and then the faith comes because God has called us and we hear his calling. And so then the security that comes with that is, I failed. How do I know if God has loved me? And the answer is, well, it wasn't about anything that you earned or deserved, but aren't we supposed to have faith? Yes, you're supposed to have faith, but now my faith is weak. But it doesn't depend on your faith, it depends on the God who calls you. So in the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is the standards of the Presbyterian Church, one of the questions it grapples with is, what happens if an infant dies? Because in the Catholic Church, you know, at the time of the Reformation, the idea is if the Church baptizes the infant, they're saved, and if the Church doesn't baptize the infant, they're not. And could you imagine a family that, you know, has a child die at the fourth day after birth, or you know, you live far enough and it's winter and you're waiting till the summer for the child to get baptized and then it's 6 months. So the Westminster divines, that's what we call them, we're working through the concept of election and saying, well, actually, if it always depends on God's grace and God's appointment, it actually helps us to understand that through the covenant of God has given me these children, that it doesn't depend on their being able to articulate the faith or understand or believe, but it depends on God's grace, and God can show grace even to somebody who has not yet had the chance to articulate the faith. And so when the Bible talks about election, it's those two pieces, because for first century Gentiles, the argument was, well, you need to become Jewish in order to become a Christian. And what Paul argues in Galatians is, no, it's like you've been adopted as children, which is a way of saying God has chosen you. Isn't that the argument for, you know, for kids that are adopted, where they say, I don't belong in the family, but the parents say, but we chose you. It's the same thing in Galatians. You know, we don't belong because we're not circumcised. And it says, but God chose you. So the summary towards the question is, the question for each of us is not, am I elect? But is the gospel true? And when we can say, yes, the gospel is true, then it shows that we have evidence of thinking we're one of the elect. And the reason that's important is because our job is not to, like, God knows those whom he has chosen. He knows whom he sets his love on. And we don't know that. So when we go out into the world, we don't say, hey, this weekend I had a retreat with a bunch of elect Christians and now I'm going to work with a bunch of people that are not elect. Because you don't know what God may do with your angry coworker in 10 years. God may call them in his appointed time. And so you don't know if your coworker is elect or not. So bear witness to them. Tell them the gospel. And so long as they're not believing, it doesn't look like they're one of God's elect, but you don't know because you're not God. So God knows those who are his. And on the other hand, you know, Peter uses the language of making your calling and election sure, which is as you grow, you don't depend on this is me, my commitment, but you understand it's God who calls me, and so I'm gonna going to prove that by trusting him more and more. And so let me make sure that I got the heart of this. There was a question, is it fair? Yeah, I haven't. Here's the hard thing about the Bible. What's fair is that all of us get what we deserve. We've all sinned, and then God just hands us over to our folly. Grace is above fair. Grace is, despite the fact that God has every right to just ignore us, he set his love on some of us. And why me rather than somebody else? I don't know. It's not because God thought I would be more useful to the kingdom, or because I had done more, or because I was smarter. It's because God loved me. And I don't know, but rather than saying, okay, I'm on the winning team, God, this is different than kids choosing in the schoolyard on the basketball team. I was the non-elect in most cases, as the elementary school, the non-athletic kid. I was always among the last two. The kingdom is not like that. Why has God chosen me? Because God is love. So don't think, it's not like, okay, God is going to make me useful to the kingdom, so that's why he picked me on his team. God is love, and therefore I can rest in that. So the question, is it fair? It's better than fair. Fair is, all of us get what we deserve. God is not giving many of us what we don't deserve. Now, if God could have shown the same kindness for others, that's the mystery where Paul talks about, well, look, there's some, in Romans, he talks about, there's some common elements and some holy elements. You know, in your home, you have your normal plates that you eat off of, and then you have the special plates for special occasions. Why are there some people that experience God's common grace, and they get life, and they get to enjoy what's good about it, and some people that have his eternal life? Why does God not set his love on everyone? That I can't answer. But I understand the impulse, is it fair? But that's where I think the foundation is. Fair would be nobody gets anything. Grace means God is not just being fair, God is being generous. And therefore, our instinct is to be thankful. That's as much as I'm going to say for the sake of time on that one. But it's a hard topic. I think I've mixed up the papers today. Did I get them all? I think I've answered every question there. So I don't know what we want to do in terms of 2 o'clock. Do we want to open it to hands, or is that too risky that we'll be here till 4 o'clock? I think I answered all of the written questions. If you wrote a question that I didn't answer, come and find me. Time to go? Or I see one question. I'll take one, and then it's up to David to if we take another one.
What's the you said that your church is a lot of intellectuals, investment bankers. What's the hardest, what's the most challenging thing in ministry to them?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You use the language of intellectual, which is interesting. My church is filled with very smart people, but not necessarily philosophically oriented people. So we have people that sort of by hard work nail the SAT. And then what I'm finding is a lot of them are not coming in asking the big questions of life, although they have the intelligence for it. They're more thinking of the practical questions, which is more success-oriented and more performance-oriented. So in my particular context, and I imagine many of you are like this, I think one of the hardest things is people are coming with an identity that's so formed around achievement, accomplishment, and success, that the people in my church, most of them, we're not great with evangelism, so a lot of people are coming already as Christians, so they're coming in and they're knowing, I know that God is more important than my work. I know that achievement is not there. So I think one of the hard things is, one, really convincing people of what they know is true, but they have a shallow belief of, but the other thing, the challenge for us in our context, although this changed a little bit positively after COVID, is a lot of the fields people were in, they were working 70, 80, 90 hour weeks because it was required of them. So I remember, this is unusual, but I remember doing premarital counseling for one couple at 9 o'clock at night, and I would do it in Midtown because it was a guy that was like, you know what, at 8 or 9 o'clock, the office thins out. I could get away for an hour and then go back to the hour and work till 1 in the morning, go back and work till 1 in the morning. So he was like, if you could meet me at 9 o'clock, I could get out of the office for an hour, hour and a half. So to take people, and that's not everybody, but to form a community where people are basically saying, I'm so proactive of filling my life. And so again, for a lot of our people, it's like my family's not in New York. So when I'm here, I'm working, I'm doing the things that I'm interested in. So the New York lifestyle, I'm gonna go out and have a good dinner. And I know church is important, so I'm going to build that in, but I'm going to build in, okay, is the church service an hour and a half? I'm going to build in now at 45 minutes. I'll stick around 15 minutes afterwards. And one of the challenges we have is to say, you know, in the long term, the relationships are important, that if you're scheduling an hour and 45 minutes and expecting everything to happen there, and then you're only here three times a month because you're visiting family or you're going on vacation, that over 2 or 3 years, you're gonna feel disconnected and you're gonna not know why. You're gonna think it was, oh, the church wasn't loving or they didn't welcome me, but you just came briefly, you came for the event. You engaged the event and then you left. So I think for us, the challenge is to positively, because people that really want to work hard, I mean, that's a good trait, to really feel like you're devoted to doing something, to accomplishing, achieving. Those are all good values. But in our context, I think the problem is, but there's also a value of something like community and life together. And trying to do both is difficult. And you know, like what will happen, we'll have somebody that maybe lives on 79th Street. My church is on 121st Street. They live on 79th Street. They work on 42nd Street. So to come up to 121st Street, it's already like, it's going to take me 20 minutes to get there, 20 minutes to come back, that's 40 minutes. And I'm allotting an hour, hour and a half. Then it starts to feel like, you know what, it's not, if I'm running 10 minutes late, it's not worth it. And one of the challenges for me, the community piece, and this is actually one of the things that you know, seeing families here that have known each other for 30 years, at Emmanuel it feels like the bulk of the people I've known for two. So how do you go deep? And then for the rest of us that have been around for 10 or 15 years, are we spending the time together to really develop that kind of depth? So in my context, it feels that encouraging intelligence, hard work, accomplishment, ambition, all of those things, how do you encourage that, but make sure it's not idolatrous? How do you keep the gospel first? And one of the negative byproducts is you can see something's wrong if you never have time to sit with the suffering person because it will take too long and you need to get something done, then I think your achievement is more important than the gospel community. So that's what feels like one of the challenges unique to my context. I mean, we have all the challenges that every church has, but that feels maybe more distinct to a Manhattan church than other churches, as far as I think. Yeah. All right. Do I close us in prayer? Yeah, let me do that. Our Father, I imagine that our time together, because we talked about real things, produced lots of questions. And I just pray for each of us that as we go out of this weekend, we would have good questions to really grapple with, so we would be thinking about things that really matter. And so as we go, I pray that each of us would have the grace of your Spirit to teach us, so we would get answers for the things we're grappling with. That you'd be working in the areas where we don't know or can't control. But also I do pray for the friendships here and the community here, that as they're trying to figure out life out, that this would be a community where your word is informing and your Spirit is applying, so that we really are growing in grace. And so I just pray that some of the big topics that we started to raise this weekend, as people grapple through the implications or try to work it out in the upcoming weeks, lead us so that we would gain knowledge, information, trust, and may we go safely back home with your peace and protection. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Thank you all.